Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of whether government by extortion is the new normal, given Republican threats to hold the debt ceiling hostage following their shutdown of the government. John Dean, the former counsel to President Richard Nixon, who has a forthcoming article at Justia, The Legality of Government by Extortion, joins us to discuss the capture of the Republican Party by extremists and whether the endangered species of traditional Republicans will make a comeback. Then we will speak with Richard Parker, who teaches economics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, about the motivations behind the apparently suicidal behavior of the Tea Party Congress. We will discuss the method to their madness and whether it is really and who is really driving the country further and further to the right, and whether we are heading for a possible repeat of the 1937 recession if they up the ante from their shutdown of the government and bring about a government default, which will likely trigger a global recession. Then finally, we will look into the launch of the Affordable Care Act in the midst of a government shutdown with insurance insider Wendell Potter, the former chief corporate spokesman for Cigna and head of corporate communications at Humana. We will discuss the well-funded forces trying to sabotage Obamacare and the growing likelihood that as the American public learn more about the Affordable Care Act, the less traction the lies and distortions by its opponents will have. And joining us now is John Dean, who is the former counsel to President Richard Nixon, and prior to that was chief minority counsel to the Judiciary Committee of the United States House of Representatives and associate deputy attorney general of the United States. Today, John Dean is a best-selling author who writes on the law, government, and politics, and his latest book is Pure Goldwater, and his forthcoming article at Justia is The Legality of Government by Extortion. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Dean.
Thanks, Ian.
And it seems, though, as one who has been the counsel to a president of the United States, John Dean, it seems that what the GOP are ultimately demanding of the White House is a constitutional surrender by or from the Obama presidency. And if that were to happen, wouldn't that be the end of the presidency?
Well, it would be a very, very bad precedent. There is one hurdle they've got to leap first is a Democratic Senate before they can get directly to a concession by the president. But obviously, neither one should concede to extortion. That is a terrible precedent.
So is he really – I mean, he folded over the last time the debt ceiling was threatened. And if you listen to what Paul Ryan said today, it's pretty clear that they plan on keeping the government shut for 2 weeks. And in that interregnum between this shutdown and the debt crisis, they're going to use the debt crisis, hold it hostage. And, you know, that's basically, Paul Ryan calls it a forcing mechanism.
A gun in the head. Yes, is a forcing mechanism. I don't think it'll work. I can't imagine a president being extorted into a legislative process. It is so abhorrent. I think eventually the public will absolutely rebel. It'll be the end of the Republican Party. I just don't think they can throw all their chips on trying to overturn Obamacare by upsetting the world economy.
But, the conservative press covered the meeting at Williamsburg that took place after the stinging defeat in 2012 when the Republican House and senators got together and plotted strategy, and they came up with what's called the Williamsburg Accords, which got a lot of coverage on the conservative press but scant coverage on the liberal press. And essentially what they decided was that they wouldn't negotiate with the White House and they wouldn't negotiate with the Democratic Senate. And they haven't. I mean, this last-minute ploy to have consultation and appoint a couple of people to discuss, bringing the bills together in conference or conferees, as they call them. The Dems have been trying to get them 18 times, I think, on the to talk about the budget, and they've refused. So this shouldn't be seen, I don't think, John Dean, as an isolated act, this shutdown of the government.
No. In fact, many of them ran on shutting down the government. They pledged to do so when they ran for office. So they're doing exactly what they said they would do. They are accomplishing their goal. The problem is they happen to come from districts with low information voters. And at some point, the fact that it is affecting them, these voters, and who thought it was a good idea to shut down the government, may have a change of mind when they see everything crumbling around them.
Well, but that means that the U.S. has to, the American people and the country has to feel pain in order to come to their senses.
Well, that's the way they think. I mean, you can't. These people, some of them have no legislative background. There's a core of about 30 members of the Tea Party caucus who are just unmovable, and they have been able to sway enough of their colleagues in the House to put up this unified front. And at some point, that's going to give, too. I don't think 30 of them can hold, because there are a few moderates or relatively moderate. When you call Peter King a moderate, that's
right.
That's stretching it. So, you know, this has to all shake itself out, obviously, but I just... you know, they've never been through this before, and they're pushing the envelope awfully hard.
But it does seem, when you watch them on television explaining what they're doing over this these last few days, they don't make any sense, and they're all speaking off the same hymnal, the same talking points. But I think there's something else going on here, surely, and that is that most politicians, their primary focus is on getting reelected. And aren't these guys worried about somebody even further to the right, an even more zealous Tea Partier running against them in the next primary, and that they're really covering themselves by doing what they're doing to insulate themselves against being primary? Because one of the most conservative guys who's leading the charge along with Ted Cruz is Mike Lee, the senator from Utah, who literally got his Senate seat in the primary where they didn't even have an election.
Well, it's true that a few Tea Party people have been able to get through the primary process and actually get elected, but that's actually more the exception than the rule. You know, I did a book called Conservatives Without Conscience, where I tried to understand the mentality that we're seeing surfaced in the Tea Party. I was actually looking at the hard right rather historically, and I found, based on social science, so I'd be very interested to hear what your next guest says about motivation, that about 30% of the population fall into the authoritarian personality category. These are classic authoritarians at work. You know, they salute, they march in lockstep, and do what they're told, with a few leaders who have rather bizarre ideas. But there is not enough of the population, based on the studies I saw, that they can ever really take control. Sooner or later, the more moderates are going to, they just outnumber them. It's, you know, it's 70 to 30. So, you know, I'm not worried in the long run. In the short run, I think they can do a lot of damage.
Again, I'm speaking with John Dean, who's the former counsel to President Richard Nixon, and prior to that was chief minority counsel to the Judiciary Committee of the United States House of Representatives and associate deputy attorney general of the United States. Today, John Dean is a best-selling author who writes on the law, government, and politics, and his latest book is Pure Goldwater, and his forthcoming article at Justia is The Legality of Government by Extortion. So, given...
Which, incidentally, I found it to be illegal.
Well, that's one of the things I find so extraordinary about the inconsistency here. The official policy of the United States government is not to negotiate with terrorists and hostage takers. I mean, that is the official policy. So I'm wondering why President Obama doesn't point that out.
That he's just following a consistent policy pattern.
Exactly.
The extortionist doesn't care about niceties, as you know. And I'm glad to see Obama has at least hyped the rhetoric a little bit, and he's now calling them their ransom seekers to do their normal job. But I think it's going to require some tougher language along the way.
But do you think that in my opening I mentioned, and I don't know whether you could consider yourself an ex-Republican or a recovering Republican.
Well, I have been an independent for 40 years, so...
So, well,
I'm obviously, I would be embarrassed to be a Republican today.
But what about this idea of the endangered species of the traditional Republicans? Do you think they will make a comeback? I mean, they've gone along with this, and Boehner has, and you can see the tortured look on his face that this is a man being whipsawed. I mean, maybe he's just a melancholy gentleman, but what do you think?
Well, my Republican friends are somewhat embarrassed by this, but they kind of brush it off. And I'm talking about some who are elected officials. And they really are just letting this play it out because they're, as you say, worried that indeed this thing not get out of hand. And so they're letting this radical element have its day, but they're not going to let them ultimately have their way.
Well, how are they going to stop them so far?
Because they will actually join the Democrats in stopping this activity at some point.
If they're allowed to get a vote.
They're allowed to get a vote.
And
well, there are ways to get around. There are procedures. I used to work for the House of Representatives. There are procedures in which the minority can get things to the floor. It's tortured. It takes time. But if that indeed becomes apparent, there are ways indeed to do that.
So do you think then that the Peter Kings of the world, I think there's about 12 mostly northeastern Republicans, and they've been pretty much the endangered species for some time now. If you go back to Nixon's Southern strategy, it looks as if the Republicans lost the Northeast and picked up the South. I mean, so there aren't too many Northeastern Republicans left, but most of them, and if one or two are Californians and a couple of Virginians, are apparently getting wobbly.
I would think that would happen inevitably. They value their seats too, and most of them have much more seniority than the Tea Party people who are now the tail wagging the dog.
So, John Dean, what is this phenomenon? You referred to it as low-information voters, that you have these very hardcore people in these rural constituencies that produce these Tea Party candidates. And the primary process seems to what really matters in the Republican Party and to a lesser extent in the Democratic Party. And we know that zealots tend to show up at these meetings and they are the ones that are threatening these people. And that is presumably why they are being so extreme. But it seems to me that in a curious way, the floodgates for the low-information voters was opened by those that chose Sarah Palin. And ever since then, we've had this new phenomenon in American politics, which is essentially, reached its peak now with the shutdown.
Well, all you have to do is listen to Fox News a little while, and you can hear what low-information voters are learning, and some who think they're actually informed. The other thing that I think you've got to put in the equation is the big money that came in from the Koch brothers to help with a national redistricting plan, where they took states where they saw that they could quietly shove through reapportionment plans during the last census, many of which, to my amazement, the Justice Department hasn't gone in and contested. There is some litigation out there. I've really never sat back to see where it is and what it's doing. But a lot of the states that are drawn in a way that has provided the safe seats for Republicans and given them their slight majority in the House can maybe subject to being contested. And that would happen before the next centennial census. So that's another possibility to disrupt this Tea Party power.
Well, that is mystifying as to why Holder hasn't done anything about that. And it's equally mystifying why nobody on Wall Street has gone to jail. But don't you think that The facts are pretty clear on this, aren't they? I believe that Democrats in the House got several million more votes than the Republicans. I mean,
absolutely. The Democrats represent more Americans than do the Republicans,
right,
in just sheer numbers. And there's no question that there has been a playing with the districts. The one man, one vote is not reflected. And that's partially due to the fact that each state has its own set of districts and our whole system of federalism.
And do you recall ever a time when the government was shut down under a Republican president?
I do. in fact, it starts in 1980 with Ronald Reagan, who thinks it's a cute game to play and does it when he vetoes a bill knowing it's going to shut down the government. So this is really long-time Republican policy. Mm-hmm. If you say, do I know any examples where the Democrats have provoked it, I don't.
That's what I was asking, yeah.
But I see it as a consistent Republican policy that starts with Reagan in 1980.
So what is the ground between an authoritarian and a thug?
Well, there actually are some decent authoritarians. Understand that there are two types of authoritarians. One of those who are up front and the leaders, and the others are the followers. The followers tend to be pretty passive, and many of them don't even want to be leaders. But there are always amongst the ranks of the followers those who would like to overturn the leader. But the authoritarian personality sounds like everybody wants to be in charge and be the number one Nazi, and that isn't the way it is. It's the passivity of the leadership. So some of these authoritarians can be actually delightful people, although they're quiet bigots. They don't want they don't want people who don't think like them, so on and so forth. But they're not necessarily thugs.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, can you give us a preview of your article at Justia, The Legality of Government by Extortion, in the sense that if there is a legal framework to deal with this, then perhaps there's a way out of this?
Well, first thing that shocked me is how little legal commentary there has been on this, notwithstanding the fact that it's been going on for quite a while. The only legal scholar I could find who really looked closely at it was a Columbia professor in 2000, who just found it conspicuously unconstitutional. There's just nothing in the Constitution that provides for interruptions of government, the only way you can change perpetual government in the United States is either to amend the Constitution or a revolution. And this is short of both of those. So these people are just not honoring a document they've taken an oath that they've also violated to protect and defend the Constitution and its perpetual government. So there are those two bases. It also is unethical, not to mention unseemly. It's unethical in that it violates the first rule of the House, which you'll do nothing to bring discredit on the House. Well, these people have taken the House down to the lowest approval rating in the history of the body. And maybe, I don't know even who the 10% are that support it, other than maybe their families. So the bottom line I tried to get to is there a legal remedy for this? And the short answer is there is none. There is no standing for anybody to go to court. It's a political question. The Congress clearly has the power of appropriation to decide how much money and when they appropriate. So there is no way that somebody can get into court in a federal court which could have the power to tell the Congress to act, but would never do it because of the political question doctrine.
Well, just in closing, though, if there's no legal remedy, is there a political remedy? I mean,
yes.
This president seems to be considerably more passive than, say, Bill Clinton. I mean, Bill Clinton was a kind of a war horse. How he survived his own peccadilloes with Lewinsky, et cetera.
I tweeted last night to the White House, don't send out for pizza with interns.
Well, but there's a pattern here. They tried to get rid of Clinton via impeachment, and they're trying to get Obama, the Republicans, to constitutionally surrender.
There is a political remedy, and that is where the president takes the bit and runs with it and calls them for what they're doing and turns the public opinion totally against them. He hasn't done that yet. The other is the voters just become so outraged with his behavior. And a third is the markets. When, for example, if foreign creditors start selling bonds because they think the stability of our economy is in trouble, that's when you're really going to see the pressure build up.
So, in other words, a shutdown may be an act of stupidity, but the upcoming debt crisis is extremely dangerous and could be incredibly reckless.
Very dangerous.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us, John Dean.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with John Dean, who is the former counsel to President Richard Nixon, and prior to that was Chief Minority Counsel to the Judiciary Committee of the United States House of Representatives and Associate Deputy Attorney General of the United States. Today, John Dean is a best-selling author who writes on the law, government, and politics, and his latest book is Pure Goldwater, and his forthcoming article at Justia is The Legality of Government by Extortion. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the method behind the madness of the Tea Party Congress.
Come on now, who do you, who do you, who do you, who do you think you are? Bless your soul. You really think you're in control? Well, I think you're crazy. I think you're crazy.
Outside the passion, millions put them into power. Expect a little more back for their taxes. Like school books, beds in hospitals, and peace in our bloody time. All they get is old men grinding.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Richard Parker, who teaches economics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and is a former managing editor of Ramparts, was a co-founder of Mother Jones magazine, and serves on the editorial board of The Nation. His books include The Myth of the Middle Class and John Kenneth Galbraith, His Life, His Politics, His Economics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Richard Parker.
Good to be with you, Ian. How are you this evening?
Very well, thanks. And do you believe that that there is an intention on the part of this Tea Party caucus and the leadership in the House to continue this shutdown of the government? One clue might be what Congressman Ryan just said today, that we have a debt limit. I'm quoting him. We have a debt limit coming. Most budget agreements in the past have always involved debt limit increases. We think that's a forcing mechanism. And then he goes on to say that that's what we need, a forcing action to bring the two parties together. We don't want to close the government down, but we want to open and we want fairness and we want a budget agreement that gets the debt under control. So there you have it, I think, don't you, that we're heading they're going to use these next 2 weeks to leverage the next crisis. So what's your sense?
Oh, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I think we're in for a very difficult period. I have for some time anticipated that this would come this week, and I'm actually one of those people who thinks that they might take us over the cliff on the debt ceiling, and that we could go into a period of 2, 3, 4 weeks where we're operating in an environment that is extra legal in some sense, that in effect the government will try to contain its costs by simply continuing this furloughing, expanding the furloughing, starting to cut a variety of services, there would be a nervous market reaction. I'm not one who thinks that Armageddon will come immediately, but there will be a growing apprehension. I mean, I think that the governments of our major trading partners understand that we're in the midst of a political crisis, and for a whole lot of reasons, including the recovery of their own economies, will not take precipitous action. But I think that there will be a reaction from the markets, and I think that the markets will pull back from terror. They'll initially be frightened. They'll pull back. They'll then see whether there's a political agreement. If there's no political agreement, the markets will dip further. It'll go step by step in terms of market reaction. But I do think that we very well could go over this debt ceiling cliff.
So if we do, Richard Parker, go over the cliff on the debt ceiling, would it precipitate a recession similar to what happened in 1937, where in the midst of the Depression you had a downturn because of the recovery was throttled? And, you know, it's pretty clear that that is a Republican strategy, to throttle this recovery. That's been clear from day one.
I don't think it would be as severe as 1937, because I don't think that this Depression that has been materially as severe for most Americans is the Great Depression. But we could have something very severe.
And how long could this? You're saying that it won't necessarily be Armageddon, but how long before? Hello. Unfortunately, you're dropping out on us. The call's dropping out. So. Okay, we'll have to call him right back. I'm sorry. I believe he's at a hockey game for his son. So normally we like to get people on landlines, but sometimes it can't be done. So let's hope that we can get Richard Parker back here momentarily. Again, he teaches economics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, is a former managing editor of Ramparts, and was co-founder of Mother Jones Magazine, and serves on the editorial board of The Nation. His books include The Myth of the Middle Class and John Kenneth Galbraith, His Life, His Politics, His Economics. I hope we can talk a little longer here, and that you're in a better spot on the hockey field there.
We're out of the hockey rink. We're on the way home. I just went through a tunnel at the Tobit Bridge. That may have been in the...
Oh, that's what happened. All right. Yeah. So just walk us through the possible scenario that we've agreed that this shutdown of the government may only be the beginning of a strategy that will go on for a couple of weeks until the October 17th deadline on raising the debt limit. And through that period, as Congressman Ryan has said, they want to use the debt limit increase as a forcing mechanism, which is a polite way of extortion. So walk us through if we do go over the cliff and what it's going to do in terms of setting back the economy.
Well, in effect, what's going to happen is that the Treasury cannot issue more Treasury bills to place on the market, because it will have exceeded its limits in terms of issuance of total debt. Outstanding, you can't issue new debt, that is new bonds, and get money out of the markets in order to meet the cash needs of the federal government, to pay Social Security, to do all sorts of other things. Now, what you do then is the federal government has to drastically cut back its expenditures to try to manage as best it can within the available cash flowing in through its tax revenues, through Social Security payments, through income tax, et cetera, et cetera. But this is going to be very difficult, and the markets know that it's going to be very difficult. And so what will happen is that bond prices will start to rise, interest rates on bonds will start to rise, because the perceived risk of holding U.S. Treasury bonds will suddenly become much greater. How, you know, what will happen? What will we do? Now, huge institutional holders, that is foreign governments and institutions, have incredibly long time horizons and would be willing to buy bonds in the secondary market at those higher prices, but that doesn't necessarily put new cash in the hands of the federal government, because this is trading in the secondary markets. And so what you'll see is the bond interest rates will rise precipitously. The markets will start to show signs of trouble in other bond markets. The flow of cash that's been coming into the United States, because we've been seen as a safe haven and as a place where when the rest of the world is going crazy, you can always carefully park your money in the U.S., will be eroded. And what's going to happen then is, even when we get a settlement of this, and we will get some kind of settlement, you're going to have created a new climate of perception around U.S. market securities, U.S. government securities, which means that the cost of borrowing for the federal government is likely to rise on an average basis to place higher than it would have been, meaning that the effective ability of the government to borrow at a cheap rate is going to be significantly reduced. And that's going to have long-term structural impacts on the federal government and on the American economy, because when treasuries are no longer trusted, then all markets for financial instruments related to the United States, and then indirectly to much of the rest of the world, are going to become perceived as shaky. And that's not a good environment when you're trying to come out of a global recession.
And the Treasury is still the gold standard in the world economy,
Absolutely.
So Richard Parker, the previous guest, John Dean, was suggesting that the Tea Party people survive and thrive because their constituents are what he referred to as low-information voters, and that they maybe will go through a learning curve if things get bad for them. But at this point, they're just as riled up as their representatives are. Do you have any? I know I don't. At the risk of indulging in cheap psychiatrics, do you have any idea about their motivations? Is there a method to their madness? Go ahead.
I think several things. I think sometimes all of us, when we think that our opponents are behaving irrationally, ought to think of what I call local rationality. Members of Congress are elected by their congressional district. Senators are elected by their state. I just had lunch with Al Franken this weekend, and he was saying, how powerful it is to be a senator of the United States, but you're a senator from Minnesota. And so when he worries about reaching compromises with the Republicans, he has to think about Minnesota business, Minnesota industry, Minnesota farmers, as well as the good interests of the United States. And that local rationality is what's driving this. I mean, I think that when we get into a place where we start to yell about the irrationality of our opponents and we treat it as some new novel crisis, we're forgetting our own history. America has been clouded since the beginning with these kinds of showdowns that have occurred. We had a showdown in the 1830s. We had a horrific showdown in the 1860s called the Civil War. We had a showdown in the 1890s around the populist upsurge of William Jennings Bryan. We had another one in 1932. We had another one in 1970, and that led into the Reagan election. This is a very divided country. I remind students when I teach them that the phrase the United States of America was employed in the plural up to the Civil War. It's only after the Civil War that we began to talk about the United States as a singular. And, to bind this country together where there are so many groups separated geographically, religiously, ethnically, and around core ideas, people vote in large measure as an affirmation of identity and community and an affirmation of the values of their community. And it's the minority of voters, in truth, who actually are able to see national interests in ways that are, in fact, effectively able to lead politicians toward compromise. Now, we talk about some kind of golden age in the recent past where politicians could get work done, as if the 50s and 60s and even 70s were great times. But you have to remember that the dark shadow of communism was hanging over that entire period, and it bludgeoned a lot of otherwise dissenting views into conformity that were necessarily going to disappear in terms of their conformity once the perceived threat of a Soviet empire was removed from the world stage. And we're now in a period where there is no single guiding external threat. Al-Qaeda and Islamic fundamentalism are by no means of the same scale or the same magnitude as a state-to-state threat that was represented in the Soviet-American struggle of the 1940s through the 1990s. And there's a kind of way in which the parts of the American vehicle start to shake loose when there isn't that single road that drives us for us all to drive down. And I think that we're in actually a period of an era change. We had a long era that ran from the end of the Second World War right up through Richard Nixon that was broadly governed whether or not we agree in detail, broadly governed by the principles of the New Deal. And from Jimmy Carter up to Barack Obama, we had a long conservative period governed by, in essence, the values represented by Ronald Reagan. Now, the fact of the matter is that Ronald Reagan's era didn't deliver on its promise. Its promise was balanced budgets and smaller government. Then Ronald Reagan delivered the largest governments, the largest deficits prior to this 2008 meltdown of the post-war period. And so there's an incredible frustration among those local communities that adhere to Reagan-esque conservative principles, who adhere to them actually even in the long Roosevelt period, but about which they were pragmatic for a few years because their economic suffering was so great. They're now bound to these principles in a way that means that it's very difficult to shake them loose in those local reasoning systems from their beliefs. They see the external world as a threat, and they mean to challenge it wherever they can. And that's how you get these members of Congress, the Tea Party wing of the Republican Party, willing to take us over a cliff. They have not been lifted out of their local rationality and their local experience in a way that makes them think that there are national consequences from their local behavior yet. And they see instead a narrative of the nation going awry that is an absolute threat to the continued existence of their local rationality and their local existence. And they're fighting like mad because of that narrative in their own imagination.
But Richard Parker, can't we add to this that picture of minority government, which is what we have now, a government by extortion? We have a minority through gerrymandering in the House, and that these people are all being funded, particularly like the Ted Cruz's and others, are being funded by the Koch brothers and by the Club for Growth, which is funded in turn by plutocrats. So, isn't that a situation where a handful of plutocrats are pushing the government further and further to the right?
Well, it's true, everything that you said, but it's also true that this has been characteristic of America in earlier periods, 1890s. The multimillionaires of the 1890s, who were lined up by Mark Hanna, who was the Karl Rove of the Republican Party a century, 130 years ago, was not at all unlike what we're seeing today. The Liberty Lobby in the 1930s, the same sort of thing. The role of Texas oil millionaires like H.L. Hunt in the 1950s in spreading their extremism in the John Birch Society. Very similar today. We have to assume not that this is some new upswelling that America has no experience with, but that we have had to fight these kinds of battles in which plutocrats have stepped forward to finance and encourage extreme right-wing activity that has been characteristic of the Republic from the late 19th century forward. And that doesn't make it easier, that doesn't make it less dangerous, but it means that we have been in this kind of battle before, and it ought to encourage people to realize that these forces can be turned back, because they have been. Not permanently, that's the whole point, they keep recurring, but they can be turned back. And I do think that we have a moment here where this economy is going to take a beating as a consequence of this Republican Party, Tea Party recklessness, that I think actually could begin to create a new political era that looks more democratic beginning 3 to 5 years from now. But we're by no means there yet.
Well, Richard Parker, I thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Delightful to talk with you as always, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Richard Parker, who teaches economics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and is a former managing editor of Ramparts, was the co-founder of Mother Jones Magazine, and serves on the editorial board of The Nation. His books include The Myth of the Middle Class and John Kenneth Galbraith, His Life, His Politics, His Economics. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the launch of the Affordable Care Act with a former insurance company insider.
one would know how tired they've grown of talking and telling their lies. Oh, we've got no health insurance, no cellular service, no disease they can cure. But we need more money to burn, so each person must learn the dollar amount they are worth.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Wendell Potter, the author of Deadly Spin, an insurance company insider speaks out on how corporate PR is killing healthcare and deceiving Americans. After a long career in the for-profit health industry as the chief corporate spokesperson at Cigna Corporation and as head of corporate communications at Humana Inc., he is now a senior analyst on healthcare at the Center for Public Integrity. Welcome to Background Briefing, Wendell Potter.
Thank you, Ian. Thanks for having me on.
And today, of course, is the big day for the rollout of Obamacare's exchanges. And the government website apparently is being flooded and it's wobbly, not entirely surprising. But, of course, it's all happening in the context of this desperate effort to shut down Obamacare by the Republicans. Do you have a comment on that before we talk about the nuts and bolts of the new healthcare law?
Yeah, I do. It's kind of a rich irony that the government, or at least the parts of it, is being shut down because of what's going on in Washington. But Obamacare is not one of the things being shut down. It's very ironic because the funding was already in place for the exchanges to go online. They are up and running. And you're exactly right. They've been overwhelmed with visitors to the site and people who've been calling in, and that just goes to show you what the pent-up demand is in this country for affordable health insurance. We have 48 million Americans who don't have coverage, so it's not a bit surprising to me that they're getting enormous demand today.
So is it your analysis that the reason that the Republicans went to the mat on this and at times appeared to be hysterical was simply that they're afraid that this thing's going to work? Because that's, after all, what Senator Ted Cruz admitted to in an interview with Fox News.
It's exactly what's going on here. They are so wedded to the ideology that this cannot work and that it represents government intrusion into people's lives, or that it doesn't represent true free market health care, if there is such a thing, which there really isn't. But it's they're so concerned, quite frankly, that their ideology is going to be proven wrong, that what they're doing now is frankly trying to impede it from succeeding. But that's just not going to be a possibility. But it's, I think, a last-ditch effort to try to derail something to keep this metaphor going. That train has already left the station.
But the Koch brothers are putting a lot of money behind a so-called youth group that they're fronting that's urging college kids not to sign up and talking about it as a Ponzi scheme. And what do you think their chances of success are? Because after all, it's the young, healthy people you need to broaden the pool to compensate for the sick people. The bigger the pool, the lower the prices. The smaller the pool, the higher the prices. If the prices aren't lowered, then the whole program's in trouble.
I think it is so misguided and such a waste of money and resources. I think it will actually not only not be effective, but in many cases maybe backfire. I've seen some of the ads that they have out there, and they're just laughable. And I think college students in particular can see through that. They realize it's just nonsense. And young people recognize that they need to have coverage. There's this theory that young people all think they're young invincibles, and that's a term that has been prevalent in the insurance industry. I know that from my days there. But it's not, people who are young also recognize that you need to have some protection against financial ruin, and that if you get sick or injured and that people who are young also get sick and injured, that it makes no sense to go uninsured. The other thing here, too, is I think that parents are going to be interceding. I'm a parent. I have a 26-year-old and a 30-year-old, and I know I'm not uncommon in saying that I want to make sure that my kids are protected, that they don't go bear, as they say in the insurance industry, that they have coverage for their own sake.
So as an insurance company insider and veteran, having been the head chief corporate spokesperson for Cigna and head of corporate communications at Humana, Wendell Potter, what did you make of Nancy Pelosi's remarks towards the end of this tortured insanity that went on in Capitol Hill over the last week or so? And, of course, we may have it even more. I mean, this time around, the Republicans behaved stupidly. In 2 weeks' time, if they tried to hold the full faith and credit of the United States at ransom, then they're behaving really dangerously and recklessly. So it could get worse. But in the midst of all of the turmoil, Pelosi said that the Republicans were showing their loyalty to the insurance companies. And I'm wondering, did the insurance companies renege on Obamacare? Because a lot of the criticism of Obamacare from the left was it wasn't single payer, it wasn't good enough, and that Obama had caved into the insurance business. So what's happening there?
Well, it's interesting. And one of the things, in keeping with what you just said, there are people on the left who don't like Obamacare because they don't think it went far enough. And obviously people on the right who thinks it goes too far. But the people who like it or think it doesn't go far enough are in the majority. There are more of those than there are people who think it is wrong for the country or it goes too far. And I think Leader Pelosi was correct. The insurance industry does not speak of one with one voice, quite frankly, these days. There are insurance companies that will benefit and want this to go forward because they recognize not only will they themselves benefit, but they are in this to try to make sure that people get access to the care that they need. And those are primarily the nonprofit insurance companies, and there still are many of them. And some of the new ones that are new to the scene, like the new nonprofit cooperative health insurance plans that will be offered in about 20 to 25 states. The big for-profit insurance companies, like the ones that I worked for, are the ones that are truly concerned about this. And they're the ones with the big bucks who've been able to bankroll a lot of these misinformation campaigns. They're concerned because they know, quite frankly, that this law will, in the long run, and probably in the short term, disrupt the way they do business. And it will level the playing field to make some of the smaller competitors much more successful at their expense. So that's what I would like for everyone to understand. There are some insurance companies that are operating on a nonprofit basis, and there'll be plenty of them that people can choose from in most states on the exchanges or in the marketplaces.
Again, I'm speaking with Wendell Potter, who's the author of Deadly Spin, an insurance company insider speaks out on how corporate PR is killing healthcare and deceiving Americans. After a long career in the for-profit health industry as the chief corporate spokesman at Cigna Corporation and as head of corporate communications at Humana Inc., he is now a senior analyst on healthcare at the Center for Public Integrity. So back to the launch of Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, and the opening of these exchanges. We mentioned that the government website has set up has had its problems because it's been overwhelmed. But I imagine that will eventually sort itself out. What's your sense then of how these deadlines are going to be met? Which states are cooperating and which are not? And will that make a difference? I know the governor of Florida, who comes out of the insurance business, he had to pay, I think, one of the biggest fines in U.S. history for defrauding the government. He's doing everything he can to stop it. So give us a rundown on who's up, who's down, and who's going to win.
Well, the good news here is that governors like Scott in Florida, and you're exactly right, he came out of the insurance industry and did pay this enormous fine and had to leave the company as a result of the work that he did there and the way he led the company. And he's made a fortune off of health care. And, yeah, he doesn't like the way things are going with the Affordable Care Act because it probably would affect his stock portfolio. But he's only limited. He's very limited into what he can do, and so are a lot of the other governors that are trying to block this because it was passed by Congress. And the exchanges have already been funded. One of the ironies is that while the small number of Republicans have been able to shut down much of the government, they have not been able to shut down the marketplaces or these exchanges or Obamacare at all. It is going forward, and so there's a very limited amount that these guys can do. There's not much mischief that is left that they can do to disrupt it. It's going forward, and it will be smoother in some states than others. So we have a mix of some states, like in California, the state is running its own exchange, and for many other states, the federal government is running them. That's why every state, regardless of what the governor says, will have an exchange, plus Washington, D.C. So much of this is really beyond the control, thank goodness, of many of the governors and state legislatures.
So there's been a general impression, though, Wendell Potter, that Obamacare has not been properly sold or not sold at all, whereas the other side that have demonized and have had a blank check from the Koch brothers and others, and that the misinformation has overwhelmed the factual information. So what's your analysis of that?
I don't disagree with that at all. In fact, there was an analysis earlier this year by Cantor Media, which analyzes advertising spending in the country, and it pointed out that since 2010, those who are opposed to Obamacare, including the Koch brothers, have spent $400 million, and this was earlier in the year, trying to discredit and mislead people about the law, and only $75 million has been spent by supporters to try to educate the public and inform them. And that's 5-1, and so it's not at all surprising that people are confused and misled and just misinformed. That will begin to change because at the core of these misinformation campaigns is fear, and it's the fear of the unknown. We are at the point now where we know the period of the unknown is coming to an end, so those kinds of campaigns are not going to be as effective as they have been in the past, and people are certainly beginning to sign up as we speak now for coverage that they have not had access to in the past.
So with the polls indicating that the country is evenly split, 48% of the country are for Obamacare, 48% are against, you're suggesting that those numbers can shift fairly rapidly when people start to learn about the program. But what is your analysis of why the passion is so great, particularly with the Tea Party people, who, after all, are driving these Congress people into this peculiar behavior? The only rational explanation for the behavior of the Congress is that they're more afraid of a Tea Party challenger even further to the right than they are, than they are of anything else. And that's why they're behaving irrationally. There's a sort of method to their madness. So give me a sense, then, of what you understand, Wendell Potter, is why these, you know, American working people who could benefit so much from health care, who probably can't even afford it as it stands now in the markets before Obamacare, yet they feel so passionately against it.
I'll tell you why. It's because from the very beginning of the debate on health care reform, the people I used to work for, they being insurance companies, wanted to manipulate public opinion. They wanted to try to control the debate on reform so that they could shape the public policy, so that they could shape the resulting law. And their consultants, their big PR consultants, suggested that they tell their political friends to call this a government takeover of health care, regardless of what the final bill looked like. They did that from the very beginning, and they repeated that time and time and time again, to the point that they got people believing that. And even the people who are saying it, if you say a lie so often, so many times, you'll yourself begin to believe it. But a lot of folks bought that as gospel, and they still do. They've essentially outsourced their thinking to people who've lied to them, which is a tragedy, because you're exactly right. A lot of the folks who hold that as truth are the very people who can benefit most from the changes in the healthcare system.
Because I heard Congress people in this debate, not that there was really a debate, but trying to defend the indefensible, the Tea Party is on the Hill, was saying things like, you know, we have the greatest healthcare system in the world, and Obama's going to wreck it. Now, you know, I guess, what do you do about people who simply don't deal with data? I mean, we have the worst healthcare system among the advanced democracies. The facts and figures are so stark and appalling that we spend more money for the worst outcomes. I mean, it's just unassailably true, isn't it?
It is, and I think that what we need to do is to know, just accept as a given that some people will never believe that we have a system that is not the best in the world. There are some people who just can't imagine that America doesn't have the best of everything. Just know that you're always going to have a sizable segment of the population that will believe that. Others are more willing to think critically and listen to reason and to empirical data and evidence and know that that is not true. So those are the people that you really need to communicate with. There will always be some people that just will close their ears to anything that doesn't support their own worldview.
Well, very early in the piece, I recall that Warren Buffett was very critical of Obamacare because he felt that it didn't deal with the real issue over healthcare, which is out-of-control costs, that Obama should have gone after costs first and access later, and that he got the cart before the horse, according to his analysis. What's your sense of that? Because we know that healthcare costs are the biggest budget busters. They're the ones that have been driving the deficit, not that the deficit's any longer the great problem it was. As the president pointed out today, it's gone down to a record level very fast. So even the Republicans aren't bringing that one up. But in terms of whether costs are going to be reduced, where do you stand on that?
Well, it would in an ideal world, Warren Buffett would be right. But you can't separate politics from policy. The reality is, those who profit most from the status quo are those that have the most money to spend to influence public policy, to make campaign contributions, and they would not allow the government or the Congress to start first with those costs, because when you're doing that, you're affecting someone's income or someone's profits. So you have to begin somewhere, and access is where you begin. But beyond that, there are many things in the Affordable Care Act that will serve to reduce costs. And you're right. The president noted that already we've seen a moderation of inflation in our healthcare system.
Well, Wendell Potter, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much, Ian. I really have enjoyed the conversation.
Me too. Again, I've been speaking with Wendell Potter, who's the author of Deadly Spin, an insurance company insider speaks out on how corporate PR is killing healthcare and deceiving Americans. After a long career in the for-profit health industry as the chief corporate spokesman at Cigna Corporations and as head of corporate communications at Humana Inc., he is now a senior analyst on healthcare at the Center for Public Integrity. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.